preliminary questions or issues, so if you want to just pass these up, that'd be fine. I do actually have more CDs, yeah.
Can we get them from Sue?
Actually, I have them. So if you want to just... I'll give them to Sue, though, because she's there more reliably than I am. Great. Sure. Any questions? I'll make a little housekeeping or sort of off-topic thing. If you like to sing, and if particularly you like Handel's Messiah, there is a local church, First Presbyterian Church downtown, that does a Messiah sing-along. If you've ever done that, it's really quite good. They hire the Spokane Symphony Orchestra at no small expense, which is arranged on the... whatever you call it, the front of the church. And so if you sing, you're right up next to them, and it's a great way to begin the week or the season if you're into that. So it's Sunday night, so it's, you know, sort of the beginning of exam week there. Sunday night, I think the rehearsal is at 5:30, so they spend about an hour just going through the rough spots, entrances and endings and so forth, to minimize the chance you're going to come in wrong or go out wrong. But as I say, it's a lot of fun. If you have a score, you can bring it. If you don't, they have them there. So. Meanwhile, back in the world of personal injury and mayhem. And questions? Yes? Sure. Loss of chance is a doctrine that will help the plaintiff, potentially. If the plaintiff would otherwise have difficulty establishing but-for causation, in those situations where the plaintiff's likelihood of avoiding the injury would not have been more probable than not, even if the defendant had used reasonable care. So in those circumstances where, for whatever reason, the plaintiff was already in some kind of trouble, the plaintiff's falling off a bridge, or the plaintiff's suffering a heart attack, and the defendant's negligence takes away a chance of recovery, but even with reasonable care, the plaintiff would have likely had... would have likely suffered some significant injury, or the injury that we're talking about, then the plaintiff would ordinarily fail the but-for causation test, because again, the but-for cause test requires the plaintiff to show more probably than not, if only the defendant had used reasonable care, the plaintiff would have avoided the injury. Some jurisdictions permit this loss of a chance theory, whereby the plaintiff says, well, okay, I'm not entitled to a full recovery, but I'd like to treat my chance of avoiding this injury in the same way I would a lottery ticket. So even though, yeah, the lottery ticket's probably worthless, still it was a chance of getting something, and because it has a chance of being worth potentially a lot of money, it actually has some marketable value. Now, that's the theory of it. Jurisdictions vary in their degree of liberality of extending this concept into different areas. Most will recognize some form of it in the medical malpractice context for the reasons I may have talked about yesterday in terms of, or the day before, in terms of the unique circumstances of the medical treatment. First of all, you can describe a condition, heart attack, kidney failure, some other condition where you say, okay, we have this many patients in that condition and this percentage of them survive, so that we can quantify. It actually helps the defendant in terms of saying, gee, even with good medical care, this patient probably wouldn't have avoided the bad consequence that happened. But the flip side of that is that it also gives us a way to quantify what that chance was. By contrast, if you're talking about the chance of avoiding an intersection collision or the chance of not slipping and falling on the ice or something else, we simply don't have statistics. There aren't sort of a uniform class of accidents that we could tell you, here are your odds of avoiding it. So it's harder to do that kind of quantification of loss of a chance. And secondly, the unique thing about medical care is that you have this special relationship between the doctor and the patient, such that the fear, rational or irrational, but the fear of the courts was that if doctors weren't subjected to some kind of loss of a chance theory, they would otherwise write off the patients whose chance of survival was less than 50%. Essentially, there would be no incentive to provide them with good medical care because the doctor's negligence wouldn't matter. As a legal matter, there would be no remedy for malpractice. You'd simply say, hey, that person was a goner anyway. So we apply loss of a chance to make sure those doctors don't think that way. Again, whether that's a rational or irrational reason, it is what the courts express as the reason they've applied loss of a chance in the medical malpractice context. As you move outside of that and you lose those two qualities, ease of quantifying the chance, and you lose this sort of special relationship, then the policy reasons for using loss of a chance diminish. So it's unlikely you're going to get the court to do it. And Hardy versus the phone company is a good example of that, of the way in which the court said, well, yeah, sure, we did it over there, but we're not doing it here. Yeah. Right. Well, see, ordinarily, in the absence of the loss of a chance doctrine, if the plaintiff concedes, oh, yeah, as a matter of fact, even with reasonable care by the defendant, I probably was going to suffer this injury anyway, then the plaintiff has admitted, in effect, I failed the but-for cause test. So what the plaintiff is looking for is some reason to say, but wait a minute, don't throw my case out. I want to convert this into, you know, instead of $100,000 that I lost, I what I've got is a lottery ticket of a chance that it will pay out $100,000. And I know it's not worth $100,000, but it's worth some fraction of that if I can show you that I had a chance of getting that. So again, it's a fairly unusual case where the plaintiff is, you know, falling off a bridge and is probably headed for disaster anyway, where the defendant's negligence deprives them of a chance of avoiding the injury. But where that is the case, that's where you would employ loss of a chance. I should say most students see it where it doesn't belong. They think, oh, this guy didn't stop at the red light. You know, I'm going through the intersection. This other guy was racing to try to get through the light before it turned red, but it actually turned red before he got into the intersection. I'm heading out with the green light, and he smacks into me. Well, I suffered the loss of a chance of getting through the intersection safely. You know, they're looking for a way. Well, that was a loss of a chance. Well, but you're solving a non-existent problem. If you're going through an intersection with a green light, it's not as though more probably than not you were still going to get struck by somebody. you were going to get through the intersection safely, but this bozo comes through the red light and causes an accident. So you don't need loss of a chance there to solve a problem, but many students will, you know, in their desire to find some place to stick this, again, as with other issues, you want to make sure you've correctly identified the problem before you apply a solution to it. And I fall back on my, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You have to be careful that you're not cramming something in where it doesn't belong. Make sure that, in fact, it is a nail before you get your hammer out and give it a whack. Yeah. Well, again, you would value whatever that chance was. Let's say the surgeon negligently, I come into the emergency room and they do an x-ray of my arm and they say, no, it's not broken. Well, in fact, it is broken. They negligently diagnose it. If they properly diagnosed it, there is a procedure they can do to, you know, reattach the bones and so forth. It only has a 20% success rate. 80% of the time, the bones don't grow back together again. But 20% of the time, if they do this right away, they can restore full motion to my arm. Otherwise, I have this arthritic, rheumatoid, whatever it is, something or other, and my arm just never is quite the same again. If I say the physician's negligence deprived me of a 20% chance of recovering full use of my arm, I would first have to evaluate, well, what's that worth? What's the difference between having limited use of this arm? I can't put as much weight on it, you know, it's sore, cold weather makes it act up, versus I have my good old arm again. Then I say, but the physician didn't cause me all of that damage. The physician only took away my 20% chance, and just as a lottery ticket that's got a 1 in 5 chance of paying out $10,000 is worth $2,000. Similarly, let's say the loss of the full use of my arm, if it's worth $50,000, and the physician deprived me of a 20% chance of getting that, I would say I'm entitled to 20% of $50,000, $10,000. That's the theory of how it would be applied. And again, the question is, would you do that? Would you go there outside of the medical malpractice context? Yeah. Well, that would be my guess. In other words, what I would do for exam purposes is, first of all, if I thought I was looking at a loss of a chance prospect, I would say, here's the tool I'd like to use. Will this jurisdiction let me use it? The odds rise significantly that they would let me use it if I'm in something analogous to medical care. If I'm outside of it, then I would say, gee, it would be nice if they'd let me use this, but they probably won't. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to be as dramatic as being blown up or destroyed, but there's something that makes makes it appropriate that we're using inferential reasoning rather than direct evidence. So if you go back to the mini exam, we don't know exactly why that saddle came off. You know, was there some defect in the strap that was holding it on? Was it not put on? You know, did somebody not tighten it up? we don't know exactly what caused the thing to fall off. There was no dramatic explosion or, you know, fire or whatever, but the fact is, same way in the elevator case. We don't know why that elevator misleveled. Nothing was destroyed or, you know, blown up or anything. But the fact is, we're missing the kind of evidence that we would ordinarily rely upon to say, oh, this thing was misset or what have you. The point is that res ipsa is a way to, again, infer, well, there must have been some negligence here because, you know, these things just don't happen by themselves. And that, of course, is a question you have to answer on the facts. Is it fair to say that elevators don't just, you know, mislevel, come up an inch short or an inch too high by themselves? It only happens when somebody has been negligent, or at least it normally doesn't occur in the absence of negligence. Same way with the saddle falling off. Is it fair to say that when a saddle falls off, we are entitled to infer, well, somebody was negligent in the way that was put on, because these things don't happen except when somebody's been negligent. If we can get an expert to testify to that effect, that's element number one. Accidents like this don't ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence. Then you have the control issue. Did the defendant share control of this with a bunch of other people, or was the defendant in charge of the thing for purposes of blaming somebody? And third, are there other plausible explanations? Is there some other candidate to say, well, it could have been negligence, but on the other hand, it could just as plausibly have been that the plaintiff was negligent, or some natural, you know, a windstorm, or mice ate away something or other, or there's some other plausible explanation that makes it unfair to jump to the conclusion, well, gee, because this happened, it must be because of the defendant's negligence. So again, what the court is doing is weighing the relative fairness, in effect, of allowing the jury to make this inference. Is that a fair thing to do on these facts, or is it really unfair to the defendant to simply speculate, well, it coulda, woulda, shoulda? And using those three elements, if we've satisfied those, then the courts will say, hey, it's an inference. The defendant can still come back and say, I know it looks this way, but in reality there wasn't any negligence on my part, but at least the plaintiff's entitled to put that to the jury in that form of an inference, rather than tell the plaintiff, I'm sorry, you don't have an eyewitness to this. No one can testify that the saddle was not properly secured, or that something was defective and it wasn't properly inspected, etc. Other questions, Mr. Brown? Yes. Right. 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 And remember the distinction between those two kinds of cases? What's one major difference in the way they're presented to us? Right. It's what I would call a derivative claim. The plaintiff is saying, I want damages because someone else got really badly injured. My spouse, my child, you know, this person I was with, or I witnessed all of this. Whereas in the lady on the train, she's saying that the defendant caused me emotional harm directly, not because of somebody else, but caused it directly to me. And so you have a different kind of logic I would say, that applies to each case. In the lady on the train case, which is, in effect, the defendant's negligence caused me emotional harm, that's the nature of my claim, you have to show that there's something about this case which is unusual. It's got a guarantee of genuineness about it. It's not just they were, you know, the dry cleaner screwed up my, you know, cleaning service, or the service station, you know, or the place where I got my oil changed, you know, they spilled a bunch of stuff on my carpet and whatever. You know, we're talking about a telegram that tells me my mother's dead and it's really a different Mrs. Johnson. You know, so again, we're looking at, or Cynthia Steinhauser, who goes to a mental hospital for schizophrenia. We're talking about a level of trauma that is more than just the ordinary bumps and bruises, emotionally speaking, associated with people stressing me out on a regular basis. So again, in those cases where we're not talking about somebody else's physical injury, we're just talking about an emotional injury to me, the courts have a fairly high threshold of saying there's got to be this guarantee of genuineness. Again, because of the floodgates issue, not just any old emotional harm is going to satisfy us, oh yeah, sure, why don't you seek a recovery for that? It's got to be something fairly unusual, quite unusual, I would say, this guarantee of genuineness. By contrast, in the area where I'm making a derivative claim, I'm saying I want compensation because my loved one got hurt. There's a different kind of calculus because, again, we're already in the business of making the defendant pay. Defendant's going to be paying for that physical injury and its associated pain and suffering and so forth. Now the question is how much do we broaden the circle? We've pretty much agreed that spouses are entitled to a recovery. So loss of consortium claims by a spouse don't need a whole lot of, you know, justification or special circumstances. You're good to go on that in terms of the court's readiness to recognize those kinds of claims. Once you get outside of, as you start talking about other kinds of relationships, either for purposes of loss of consortium or in this bystander context, that's where it all begins to fall apart. That is, we have these real difficulties drawing lines and saying, well, we'll go this far, but no further. Same issues about, you know, non-marital or non-technical blood family relationships, which of those count, which of them don't count. Again, the courts are really struggling, or legislatures for that matter, struggling with finding a way to define the boundaries of where we're going to go with these related party claims. So, but again, that's eased somewhat by the notion that the defendant's already getting his checkbook out. It's not like we're creating new sources of liability. We're just adding to the bill, tacking something on to the existing bill that the defendant is paying. Whereas in the Johnson versus State of New York or Steinhauser case, where we're saying if we refuse to recognize this claim, there will be no claim, the courts are much more likely to say, wait a minute, we don't do this. So, anyway, that's where I would... There's just a different body of law that you apply because the courts are thinking about the problem from a different sort of perspective. When you're in the bystander loss of consortium related parties area, as distinguished from suffering a direct emotional harm through the defendant's negligence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the same claim. I mean, all we're talking, that's why it's a Chapter 3 issue, even though in Chapter 3, we in Dillon versus Legg, we have the court raising the duty question as though this were a Chapter 1 question. Gee, I wonder if, you know, Cardozo fashion, this person is foreseeable, et cetera, et cetera. It's really not about Chapter 1 or Chapter 2 in terms of saying we're assuming all the other forms of proof would be the same, negligence, causation. What we're focused on is, but does this form of damages count? Again, the defendant's already being presented with a bill, and it's a question of, do I add this person onto the bill in addition to what's already been assessed against the defendant, assuming that in the claim against, or the claim brought by the immediate victim, say a wrongful death case or whatever, that person's already proven the elements of a negligence case and causation. They typically don't do it sequentially. They typically do it in a single suit, and the court would combine the claims into a single suit because for reasons of judicial economy, it would not make much procedural sense for Richard Rodriguez to pursue his claim against the people who dropped the pipe on him, and then if he wins, you know, Marianne claims issue preclusion, you know. But on the other hand, if he loses, she says, well, that was him, you know, I'm now going to pursue my own. The court would consolidate those two together and say, this is essentially, similarly, the parents and the children. So cases get consolidated where the liability issues are all the same. So they would occur at the same time. You'd prove one case of liability showing the defendant negligently dropped this 600-pound pipe on Richard. That in turn leads to two different claims, one by Richard, one by Marianne. It might, as we'll see in Chapter 7, the statute of limitations is told, that is, it doesn't run while a person is underage. So you could have someone bring a claim 10 years later, and the statute of limitations doesn't run on a child's claim. So, but again, the defendant would resist all of that, or at least would want to have all this stuff done at the same time rather than seriatim. Other questions? Yes. The first thing I would say is make sure you have a Paul's Graf type case. That is, if it's a situation in which the defendant is negligent, but that negligence only winds up harming the plaintiff through a fairly indirect process. It's like Kinsman Transit or some other deal where the defendant is negligent, then a couple of other things happen, and finally the plaintiff gets hurt. Then I would say we have a Paul's Graf kind of case. At which point you would say there are, you know, different ways that jurisdictions view such cases. Some view it as an issue about negligence. Cardozo, you know, thought about it in terms of the zone of danger, and people outside the zone of danger aren't owed a duty of care, and therefore there's no negligence. By contrast, other jurisdictions don't consider it a problem of negligence so much as an issue about causation and ask whether or not the a defendant's negligence proximately caused the plaintiff's injury, and it's a more pragmatic judgment involving public policy. I mean, that would be the way to sort of explain the difference between the... But I wouldn't bother with Cardozo and Andrews unless I thought I were faced with a Cardozo, I mean, with a Paul's Graft kind of case. So I've talked before about the cigarette case. The convenience store sells tobacco, sells cigarettes to these kids. They go off, they smoke the cigarettes, they drop the cigarette into a log pile. The log pile starts on fire. I added, contrary to reality, I added an additional claim where a firefighter goes to battle the blaze and the log pile collapses and he's killed. Well, he's particularly in the Paul's Graft. He's got the Paul's Graft problem because from the sale of cigarettes to the smoking of the cigarettes to the collapse of the log pile to the, you know, death that he suffered, that, you know, we're in kinsman transit country there. And so then we'd have to say what method does this jurisdiction use to evaluate such claims? But you don't want to just see Paul's Graft around every corner, so to speak. Yeah. Well, you still have a Paul's Graft issue about whether somebody selling cigarettes would foresee the potential that these would be misused and would lead to a fire, but that's more, it's both a superseding cause issue. The good thing I would say from the plaintiff's perspective in the convenience store sale case is that what happened was not an intentional act by the kid. It was the very kind of carelessness that, if it is negligent, again, if it's negligent to sell tobacco products to minors because of the risk of fire, this what happened is the perfectly foreseeable thing. Whereas, if I sell alcohol to a minor and they drop the case of beer and somebody slips and falls and gets cut on the broken glass, you know, that's not the kind of risk that I have in mind, thinking, gee, I wonder if I should check this person's ID, I wonder if they're of age. So again, the foreseeability analysis figured in both for purposes of superseding cause. Can I say that, well, maybe the convenience store was negligent, but these kids broke the chain of causation because what they did was unforeseeable and different in kind as far as its reprehensibility? Or would I say, I don't know if this is negligent or not. I mean, maybe it's negligent, but not for this reason. If it's negligent because of the risk of fire, then this is precisely the kind of risk you would be afraid of. If that makes sense. I'd say any time you have a pretty sharp right turn in the facts, so that the defendant is negligent, but that negligence doesn't result in the kind of injury, I run a red light, I hit somebody in the middle of the intersection. That's the sort of bang-bang connection between why you don't want people to run red lights and the kind of thing that happened. By contrast, I run a red light, I hit an ambulance, somebody up, you know, on the South Hill doesn't get prompt medical care. As I'm thinking about whether to run a red light, I, again, going in the Cardozo mode, is it reasonably foreseeable, putting the VCR on pause, freeze-framing the action as the guy's got his foot poised above the accelerator, should I try to make this light or should I put on the brake and stop? is it reasonable to foresee that I might run into an emergency vehicle that's on its way to rescue somebody in dire need of medical care? That's a much harder connection than, will I hit somebody in this intersection? So I think about the card, about the Paul's graph issue, and again, it's one of the reasons why I finished the chapter somewhat against my better judgment with that dumpster case. Because in the dumpster case, Paul's graph turned out to be an issue, even though one would have thought that's a relatively straightforward case. That as you're putting blocks into a dumpster, you would think about, well, what is this going to mean for the people that work around these dumpsters? It would have been different if the dumpster had gone off, you know, and while it's being unloaded, it hits somebody in the sanitation, you know, department off at the landfill someplace. Then you could say there's more of a Paul's graph issue, but I was surprised, as the Court of Appeals was, in effect, that the trial judge bit on the Paul's graph issue in that dumpster case because it didn't seem like a very tough connection. But again, what Paul's graph is all about is the unforeseeable plaintiff. Where the plaintiff was relative to the defendant, you could not reasonably foresee that the plaintiff was in peril. That's the Cardozo perspective. Andrews takes a different perspective, but at least it sets up the problem. That is, the plaintiff's off someplace out of the field of view from the defendant's perspective when the defendant's engaged in the behavior we classify as negligent. And Cardozo says the question is whether or not the plaintiff is reasonably foreseeable. Was the plaintiff in the zone of danger? Andrews says the question is whether or not the negligence of the defendant proximately caused the injury, but it's the sort of spatial relationship is the same for both. Well, the thing I would emphasize, though, about superseding causes, those are heavily dependent upon our public policy evaluation of the activity in question. That is, for example, in the sale of alcohol, we saw that the case against the convenience store was all about the public policy regarding alcohol. It wasn't so much, you know, a kind of abstract analysis of foreseeability. It was, who do we think should bear the loss here? Is it fair to put the loss on the convenience store, but not on the kid who illegally buys the alcohol and gives it to his friend? And the court says, yes, that is fair. And, you know, some of the dissenting judges say, no, that's not fair at all. Makes no sense to me. So, again, what I would say with respect to superseding cause is where you have the 600-pound gorilla who is the bad guy in the story, and you're trying to get behind the 600-pound gorilla and say, yeah, but the convenience store sold him the liquor, or Kmart sold him the hunting rifle, or some other relationship in which a deep pocket defendant sets up the 600-pound gorilla. Well, that's the point at which you want to, you know, point out the fact that depending upon your public policy read here, there may or may not be a claim against that deep pocket. The court may say, sorry, chain of causation's been broken. This bad guy acted, you know, as a superseding cause. Or the court may say, as a public policy matter, wait a minute, if you choose to sell alcohol and you wind up selling it to a minor, don't come whining to me that people are coming after you, because that's the risk that you take. These are public policy questions, as distinguished, I would say, from the sort of legal technical. The Paul's graph questions tend to be more of a kind of philosophical, technical, legal question. I don't really care about baggage scales, you know, neither does the court, but as a judge, I probably will care a lot about alcohol or about firearms or about, you know, something else like that where I think, gee, there's some, you know, bigger thing in play here that I have to watch out for to make sure the public's interest in this particular thing is treated in an appropriate way. Yeah. I'd fall back on my general rule, which is, I often analogize this to medical treatment, that there are times when if you're doing a physical exam of somebody, you will go through and describe what you didn't find, or you would say, normal, 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 normal. I looked at all these systems and they appeared normal to me. Sometimes that's a useful piece of information. I looked, I did not find. Other times, it's not such a useful piece of information. And part of it, I think, is just the sense that when you're done evaluating this case, is there some value to your client in saying, I thought about this, or noting for the record? As it happens, when you do the workup of a case, somebody comes in, they're interviewed by your paralegal or whoever it is to get kind of the facts of the case and prepare this to decide, will my firm want to accept this case and offer to take it on behalf of this client? I'd like to have a pretty full record, and I'd like to sort of pick this up in 6 months if it, you know, went out and we referred it out to, you know, an expert for evaluation or whatever. I'd like to pick up this file in 6 months for myself and read my own notes of it and know that I thought about certain things, much more so if I get run over by a truck, somebody else has to take over for me and picks up my record of the file and says, well, what did this person look at in coming to this conclusion? So, I think, again, there's a place for not only thinking about and rejecting something, but making a paper, providing a paper trail of what you were thinking. On the other hand, to the extent that no one would expect or care that in evaluating why this valve blew off of a high-pressure pipeline in a chemical plant, well, I don't think there were any wild animals, you know, roaring through the plant that afternoon. Again, that's not something, I mean, it doesn't hurt you, but that's not something I would. The other example I've used, I can't remember how many of my analogies I burned up here, but you know, again, if somebody's giving me a physical exam, telling me, well, yes, you do have slightly lowered kidney function, but it's still in the normal range, and you don't have cancer, that's a useful piece of information. But telling me I'm not pregnant is not a useful piece of information. Technically correct, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, there are certain conditions that physicians think about, you know, well, this is a condition that is sometimes associated with pregnancy, but it does me no good for the physician to tell me he's or she has arrived at that conclusion. So again, just some common sense, I think, about what it is you make note of. And as it turns out, the older you get, the more senior moments you have when you look at a file and you say, gee, at the time, this, you know, I vaguely remember this, but gee, having a complete set of notes, even at the risk of stating the obvious, is a great relief compared to assuming, well, of course, I'll remember that. I don't have to write all that down. Similarly, you should prepare something for a trial judge to sort of, you know, I think I may have mentioned that when I first started, when my first boss assigned me my first memo to, you know, memo for summary judgment or whatever it was, and I didn't even bother to recite Rule 56 because I figured, you know, if the trial judge has been there for 2 weeks, much less practiced for 10 years, I'm sure he knows Rule 56 backwards and forwards. But, you know, my boss pointed out quite correctly, you don't skip that. You say, you know, under Rule 56, a motion for summary judgment is granted when there's no genuine issue of any material fact and the moving party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Cite, you know, Rule 56. You still stick that in the brief, even though it's in many ways stating the obvious. So, again, I don't want to make you do stuff that just seems like busy work, but it's not busy work to the client, oftentimes, and it's a way of ensuring, as I've said before, that sometimes when you get an assignment and you start to go through this kind of mechanical checklist, service of process, normal, jurisdiction, normal, venue. Wait a minute, what do I know about venue in this case? You know, maybe there's an argument about venue. So that as you start to just sort of think, oh, this is a complete waste of time, suddenly as you write it down, you say, ooh, wow, maybe I should look under this rock. Maybe there's something here. So, again, these are just all ways of balancing the desire not to miss something with the desire not to clutter up your answer with useless information. Yeah. Well, a common case would be crime of various kinds. You know, a motel or a hotel has somebody assaulted in one of their rooms or in the parking lot. And the victim sues the motel or the hotel saying, you were negligent in your security. And the motel would say, well, wait a minute, this is a superseding cause. This was a guy lying in the, you know, waiting outside in the bushes to come and mug you or steal your car or whatever, and that's a superseding cause. And again, from a public policy standpoint, you say on the one hand, is the defendant being unfairly victimized because they happen to have a deep pocket, and people with money and cars and so forth are attracted to the defendant's business and then are set upon by criminals? Is it fair to make the defendant pay for that? In the plaintiff's favor in a case like that is the notion, again, foreseeability. Gee, if I've got to decide how well to light my parking lot and whether to trim the bushes and reduce the likelihood that, and have a sophisticated key and lock system that gets changed over frequently, makes it difficult for people to get inside who are not guests at the motel. As I think about that, the very reason I want to do that is because I'm afraid there are criminals who are going to assault my guests. So very foreseeable, and the public policy would probably say that's part of what you pay for when you pay for it. Other questions? I'm inclined not to have a review session. I've thought about doing this, but I do not at present intend to do anything further until a week from tomorrow. If you have a question, I'd encourage you to email me. You should expect that when I reply to your email, I'll reply to everybody. So that if you want something private back to you, that's okay. I'll take your name off as well, but I'll just say, here's a question I got, here's my answer. Yeah, I'll be in and out all this week, all next week. But email me if you want to make sure you catch me.